Alex, I think, said to me.
Shalom.
So, anyway.
A good evening to all. It's going to take us right back to... All right, so this will be the last time, by the way, that we're not starting with the next Mishnah into the Seder world. And we're going to still be a little bit in the world of the wine connection and the general realities of blessings over wine and minhagim and customs with wine that appear on the page, because here we are talking about wine, and we should, as Jewish people know, we have all these cups of wine around for all kinds of different things, and so far we've had them for the Seder and 4 cups of wine. We've had them for Shabbos. We've had them for Yontif, a holiday, the regalim. We're going to get into at least 2 other areas. One is Havdalah, where we know we have a kos, we have a cup of wine. And we also are going to see something about where wine appears in the Jewish world during weddings. And so that's going to be our foray today.
Why, they don't have wine in Greece?
They do. They do. That wasn't mentioned in the places that I went to.
Maybe they didn't have Greek at that time.
Maybe they didn't pronounce the name over the cup at that time. But they had a Brit at that time. Last time we left off, we kind of said that there was a temporary solution, if you will. We didn't read the rest of the Gemara, but let's just say that it was a solution. Shmuel says on the end of 100b2, that it goes to at the end of 101a to the beginning of 101b, okay? And actually, it's Rabbi Hanin bar Abaye said in the name of Rabbi Pedas, who said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, whether there is a change of wine or a change of place. Oh, very good. Everybody who thought we was not here is obviously in town. So whether you change your wine or you change your place, one is not required to recite a second blessing. That got us into this discussion, as it's recorded below here. If one recited a blessing and ate food in one place and then moved to another location to continue eating there, he need not recite a second blessing over the food he eats in the new place, for as long as one does not divert his mind from eating, which is called a hesech hada'at. The food eaten in both places constitutes one continuous act of eating, for which one blessing suffices. Okay, that's one possibility, but it's challenged. Meitveh. With a brayta. Shinui makom tarich levarech. But where there's a change of place, one is required to recite a second blessing. And we had this whole discussion about how you go from one roof, let's say, down to the salon. You're going to need to say a blessing and eat, even though it's the same house. By the way, some people have it that it's one corner of one room to another corner of a room, because, of course, you took your mind off of it. You might have said hello to your friend, or you might have just forgotten a little bit about it. But where there's a change of wine, here's what the Braita says. Shinu yayin ein tzarich levarech. But you don't have to, when you change your wine, recite a second blessing. Tiyuvta de Rabbi Yochanan. This is a refutation of Rabbi Yochanan's ruling that a change of place does not require another blessing. Meaning that if you change your place, one is required to recite a second blessing on the food. But the wine in this Braita was supposedly you didn't need to have a second blessing on it. And so there's an interesting kind of moment here for the Tosafot of saying, well, what are we going to do with this fact that we learned in Brachot that when you change wine, you're required a second blessing? Now we're talking about not just Pesach. We're not talking about Shabbos. We're not talking about Yontif. So we could be with Pesach. Wait a minute, when you change your wine, you're not required a second blessing? I have a tradition that we have a tradition in Masechet Brachot that we say a second blessing over wine. So what we're going to do is just stop here for a moment, the Tosfot say, and that we're going to talk about this for a second. So, is it true that when we have a change of wine, we're not required to say a blessing called Hatov HaMeitiv? So, I'm in the Tosafot, if you want to follow along in the Tosafot, Shinui Yayin Ein Tzarich Levarech. And this is on the, it's the last Tosafot on page 101A. And this one I don't have the sheets, you can just listen in. I'm going to do this rather quickly. Mihu atov hameti tzarich levarech kedamrinan behora'a baharoe. However, I learned in the Talmud, in Masechet Brachot, in a different tractate, that when you have another wine, you're supposed to bless the blessing, hatov v'hametiv. So if I said yayin, borei pri agafen, and then I have a second glass of wine, I'm supposed to make a second bracha. What's the bracha? It's not borei pri agafen again, it's hatov v'hametiv.
And what happened if you got not such a good wine?
The good and the one who does good. Well, that's what they're going to be interested in here. Uferush Rashbam, and Rashbam, Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, says, Davka hecha de mishubach min harishon. That's only when the second wine is actually better than the first. So give me an example quickly. What's an example of Kiddush and a Kiddush wine that you drink first, and then a wine that you drink second that's better? I knew someone was going to say Manischewitz, because it's the universal Jewish experience in America right now, right? We, if we were writing a Tosafot, just to give a picture of what how the world works, they didn't have Manischewitz. When Jews came to America and got the Concord grape and created the whole wine industry here, they made sweet wine for Kiddush. But that's like a totally new thing. But here we go, if we were writing, we would say, it's like when you go from Manischewitz to
something good.
And these days, thank God, there's something good. There's something
good.
You know, maybe for a while, there wasn't so much so good. Right? Now, there's some good. Napa Valley, Spain, you're supposed to drink Israeli wine according to the conservative movement's tshuva to make it,
and there is good wine,
thank God. So the Rashbam, though, in the Middle Ages hears it. No, I was talking about Davka. You make Hatov HaMeitiv. We can use the Talmud's lesson in Brachot, in blessings, the Tractate of Blessings, to say it's not every time you make a change. It's when you have a better wine. And his intention was to have a better wine. V'chein Hilchot Gedolot, and that is as the, this is the name of a code, Halachot Gedolot. That's what this code really stated one should do. V'chein Mashma B'Yerushalmi, and thus it says also in the Jerusalem Talmud. Now there's controversy over the ages as to whether or not we should really Paskin, we should decide according to the Jerusalem Talmud. It's not the most accepted mode of halachic decision-making. A little biased towards the Gemara, maybe. And they wanted the Babylonian to be the one that stood out and really was decisive. But the Rashbam, like some in modernity, likes the interaction, and so too the Tosafot, for sure, like the interaction of texts of all types that sit on the shelves of the Jewish library. And he brings forward the Yerushalmi. And he says about the Yerushalmi that this is the situation there. V'chein mashma b'Yerushalmi d'sof ketan mevarchim d'ka amar Abba bar Rav Huna amar yayin chadash v'yashan tzarich levarech. And this is also implied in Yerushalmi at the end of How Do You Bless Over Wine, in other words, which cites Abba Bar Rav Huna, that someone says, someone who drinks new wine and old wine requires a bracha. A change of wine does not. Shinui yayin ein tzarich levarech.
So what's the difference between yayin yashan and yayin chadash?
The Yerushalmi concludes wait, that hesach hadat, you've taken off your mind of drinking, that's equivalent to a change of location. That's what the Yerushalmi says. But this implies, listen to how it's going to work out, Ron. The yayin chadash v'yashan tzarich levarech, new wine followed by old wine requires a bracha, lefisha hayashan tov min hachadash. The older wine is better than the newer wine. Aval shinu yayin stam. But if you have the same kind of wine, or it's just the same, you know, it's the same specific grade of wine, and it's not better, ein tzarich levarech. You don't need to bless. Kevan she'ein yadua shehasheni mishubach. Because it's not any, it's not a known thing that this second wine is any better. So when it's really better, I know that I'm going to bless. If it's just a stam change, I don't need to bless. Okay? And that gives Rashbam the ability to say, like in Brachot, yes, I know I have to make a second blessing when I have a change of wine, but I only mean when it's a better wine.
So what happens if you don't know until you've tasted it? Well, you say the Brachot.
That's a problem, right? That would be the koshi. That would be the difficulty with the whole system, right? The Tosafot kind of have that in mind as they're continuing along to write what they're going to write next. That's one question. And Ron, what was your question again exactly?
Chadash v'yashan, they say on the top line, it says, Tzarich levarech shinui yayin chadash v'yashan.
Right.
And then they said, better and worse. So the difference between chadash and yashan, how do they know which one is the chadash and which one is the yashan, or vice versa? What's the definition of chadash and yashan is not...
Their presumption is the old
That's in the later sentence, but...
Right. So they're putting it in, you know, that it's first chadash and then yashan. So let's say I have a bottle of very bright new wine, and then I go to an older, richer wine. And so that's the something that they're assuming here within the language, that they would, that you would know that you were going to an older, better wine.
So they had a system first to use a newer wine and then to go...
It doesn't matter if it's systematic. In other words, if I bring you out a nice, bright, new wine, right, something I just bottled up that happens to come right out of the vat that I'm just making yesterday, and then I go and I take from the barrel, a very good barrel of the wine, of course it's the chadash and the yashan, and I know it's the chadash and the yashan.
But you can have chadash v'yashan tov v'lo tov. Not always age define quality.
I understand that. I understand, but now we're splicing. In other words, they Abba Bar Rav Huna Amar yayin chadash v'yayin v'yashan tzarich levarech. So he's basically assuming that you know what's chadash and what's yashan here. But listen to what he says: shinu yayin ein tzarich levarech.
That's I understand.
So that, therefore, he's taking into account kind of what you said, that not all wines are going to be one, quote-unquote, better than the other, regardless of how many days old you tell me they're how many days old. But really what he's saying is, what does he mean by that? That ultimately, if it's stam yayin, let's say we have two bottles of the same wine, then ultimately that's what it seems like he's saying in the Yerushalmi, right? But he's still holding that going from chadash to yashan, you need to bless. New to old. You're going to say a second blessing. And he assumes here that the reason why shinui makom tzarich levarech, and when you change a location, you really need to bless again, right? Because you think that even though it's the same wine, if I change my place, why do I need to bless on it again? Because it's not a matter now of the wine itself. What is it a matter of? It's whether or not I have my mind focused on that which I blessed, a blessing over.
In other words, like if you said blessing over a glass of wine and then you drink a glass of wine again 3 days later, you need a new blessing. And the idea is that you've been distracted, it's a separate event and it requires its own blessing.
And or it's a different room in the house. And so what I'm worried about in this Tosfot, which and what our tradition makes obvious, is one of the larger points that I want to make about the intentionality behind all these, what might sound and seem like minutia, is that there are two ways to look at wine already from the beginning of this Tosfot in relationship to the Gemara that we're studying. One is that I have to know my wine. This is encouraging me to be somewhat of a know-your-product kind of wine drinker, which is not a bad thing. I like to know what I'm drinking. We like to know the details. This is among Jewish people a nice piece of our culture. Where does this come from? What's the... You know, it wasn't just the vintners and the wine tasting experts in the world. You have to know a little something about your wine, obviously, to know whether this one's a younger, this one's an older, and what have you. Could be as simple as, in their time, here's a new wine that just came from my production, and here's an older barrel that's aged, and so you don't have to know as much as I'm making out to know, but at least you know that this one's newer, this one's older.
Rashbam's family, he at least...
That's right, and Rashi was a vintner, and Rashbam was part of the Mishpacha, and so you have a wine tradition here, and it's in that sense, to me, very lovely. Very lovely that they're inviting us to understand our wines. The other piece, before you hold on to what you got, the other piece is that moving from one place in a house to another place in the house has nothing to do with whether or not I've changed my wine. It has everything to do with a hesa chadat, which is my intentionality when it comes to blessing. And if I say a blessing over something, I should have full intentionality over that which I have blessed. And this is uniquely Jewish as well. I want to have, even in my life where I've, you know, strolled through the house and I've talked to this and that person, I want to have kavanah. I want to have some intentionality. And I know that I've lost it, according to the Masoret here, the tradition. I had a hesach hadat, and therefore if I move to a different location, I'm going to say another berei pri hagafen, a blessing over the wine, regardless of the status of the wine itself. That's not the issue. So with wine, it could either be my mindfulness, or it could be the wine itself. Very interesting how it could work either way, in terms of the blessings that you're invited to say.
I guess we started this discussion some time back with talking about Kiddush, and whether Kiddush counted, you know, after, you know, when you had to come in again. I find it a little bit problematic that if you know you have the not-so-good wine, and you have the really good wine, there doesn't seem to be any concern whatsoever about using the junky stuff when we're fulfilling the commandment to sanctify God, saying Kiddush.
Oh, I wouldn't call it junky, though. I would call it that they're imagining that you're wanting to do the mitzvah, even though there seems to be a progression to the better, and you might save that bottle of $46 wine and serve the $16 or the $2 bottle of Manischewitz. That's not the evaluation here. There's no valuation of wine and permitting you to use what is considered to be cheap and therefore not respectful. The reality is probably that there is the opportunity, first and foremost, for more blessings. How do we get to more blessings? They're very interested in how we praise the Creator. So it's a very different perspective than what's this kind of level of wine where we are Brei Pri Hagafen, and what's this level of wine where we are HaTov HaMeitiv. Could someone theoretically start out their night with a less expensive wine, because we know that the Jewish law says you only can make that HaTov HaMeitiv on a nicer wine, the good and does good on a nicer wine? I might, but I might do it not because I'm permitted to serve the junkie, but because I want to have both blessings at my meal. A berei pri hagafen first, and then move to this other wine. But then it says, about mindfulness, but if you kind of set it up like that, then you may not be able to bless this blessing, HaTov HaMeitiv, this second blessing over wine. It's only when you now come to the table with it because you're adding to the festivity, or...
something new as opposed to something that was plotted out to begin with, because exactly. Otherwise when you said the first blessing, you were saying it with the intention to drink first this wine and drink that.
Exactly. And that's where the mindfulness piece ultimately, I'm glad you asked the question, because that got us to this next piece of mindfulness in the whole system, and it allows us to see that we really don't want to plan it out like that. We really don't want to plant olives. Though, if you just take the common minhag of America and you think about it as manischewitz is what you say Kiddush over, and then you're going to have another glass of wine, and that's kind of the trajectory of every Shabbos or Yontif, I don't have a problem if it's become routine, habitual, and systematized to first say Borei Pri HaGafen over the manischewitz, and then move to the better wine, maybe celebrated from Israel with a Hatova HaMetiv, because in our time, we are permitted to use sweet wine for Kiddush, and in our time, we are treated to the reality that we have this beautiful, wonderful wine. So now you're making me consider how we ought to explain it, not to say you're permitted to just use a quote-unquote $3.99 bottle of manischewitz. We're permitted to use sweet wine for Kiddush, and then if we're going to drink more, beautiful, that's wonderful, praiseworthy, make a breath, make a blessing, make a second blessing.
I know people who know serious wine drinkers, but they wouldn't dream of making Kiddush over anything other than manischewitz, because the sweetness of it, it's, they're not thinking of it as wine and as you critiquing it like real wine, but the sweetness of it to them, it's just
right.
What we do.
Right. Well, right. Like, how could you possibly make Kiddush over anything else?
So American, eh?
It's so American.
Very American.
It's so American.
We're the opposite. We start out, we make Kiddush on the nice wine, and then when that's all gone, if we sort of want a little bit more, that's when I want to take out the stuff that isn't so great.
You know, you drink it like an aperitif.
We have Malaga and we have Tokai.
I
want to
drink the good wine.
It's funny because I know someone who likes manischewitz but wanted to make Kiddush on the better wine. And then took out the manischewitz afterwards to say, oh, no, I can't go through a meal without tasting a little bit of it. So.
So what is the blessing if I have the same wine and I move from one room to another, Be'esach HaDa'at, what will be the verbal content of the blessing because of Be'esach HaDa'at?
Borei Pri HaGafen, Old Pam.
The same as for the first time?
I have the same glass of wine in my hand.
Yeah.
I didn't open a new barrel.
So that's on the same wine, just moved from one room to another.
Right. Roof to salon. Yeah.
It's like drinking on an entirely separate occasion.
But now listen to this. Case comes to follow. Dekamar, Kol chavit v'chavit mevarech. On every barrel that I open, you've got a bless. Mahaya mevarech. What's the blessing if you open different barrels? V'amar Rabbi Yitzchak v'shem Rabbi Baruch Hatov HaMeitiv. That when you open the next barrel, you bless Hatov HaMeitiv. Ah, but what's my problem now? What if it's the same exact vintage? It's not better. Didn't I just say that I only do it when I've got Chadash V'Yashan? I have new and then old, or this kind of wine and then better wine? So the second case that they bring in the Tosfot from the Yerushalmi, Mashma B'chol Inyan Afilu Mitava Labesha. It even implies, it seems to imply, that when I have good wine and then it goes to even less quality wine, I say the blessing. Because I've opened the barrel. Maybe it's all about, in other words, the Tosafot say, maybe it's not about the wine at all. Maybe it's that God is good to us. I have another barrel to open. Mihu. However, let me just clarify for you here, as the Tosafot wants to do. Yesh lidchot shehayam evarech lefi shelo hayam makiro, aval im yadua shehasheni garua lo. Ah, but you could say, if he really knew the second barrel of wine wasn't so good or it was of inferior quality, then he knows he's not going to say the blessing. Hatova hametiv. He knows. And that's where it kind of comes out. But you could say, seems like they say make a blessing on that second barrel, because it says kol chavit v'chavit, every barrel you got to make a blessing. And what's the blessing? Hatov ha-metiv, the blessing that I thought was reserved for the better wine. De'al ribui yeinotu mivarech. You see, it's on the fact that there is such a quantity of wine that we can enjoy. It has nothing to do with the quality thereof.
As long as the last one is not bad.
But as long as
the last one
isn't so bad, How does he know? Because it's full of, the first cup is full of, let's say, sediment. It comes out tasting a little vinegary. You know? She'ain, it smells so strong. You can smell that sometimes. Right? You open a bottle of wine, or the barrel itself is like, when you're opening the barrel, right? Just like sometimes you open a cork, and the cork is mushy, and it's you know, falling apart, and half of the pieces are in the wine itself, and you got to think about how to strain this barrel. Maybe the barrel's wood is a little bit rotten, smelly.
You're putting down the Abbey, you put a little close, and you...
Yeah. That's a nice place to watch because it didn't change all that much over millennia. She'ein yecholin lishtoto ela midochak. And the only reason you're going to drink this wine is in case of an emergency. And by the way, we were talking about all these meals, Pesach and Yontev and Shabbos and this and that. If you just stop drink wine, you have blessings to say. And you should realize wine is such a gift that... You should bless Borei Pri HaGafen and then move to the second one that's a little better. Bless HaTova HaMetiv. Have a second blessing. Have your mind on it when you drink it. Be thankful of its profundity in this world, of how it was given to you. Yeah? And know these blessings and know that there's an ascension in the either Ribui now. We have, because when they bring these things up and they knock them down, by the way, it's another idea that you can still have. It's not saying... Oh, by the way, now you got to get that idea totally out of your head. Even though I know the Ta'ama Mitzvah now, I know that it was better wine, I still have the possibility that Tosafot brought up, explaining the passage from the Jerusalem Talmud, and that is, on the abundance of wine, I can add to my total understanding of my experience of blessing over wine. Right? Sometimes we just think that they're knocking down reasons. I'm suggesting they're using the rhetorical argumentation to present for you all kinds of reasons that you could latch onto. Oh, I like that reason. Still have the other one in mind, because halachically they decide a certain way. But not only bless on the goodness itself of the wine, the quality of the wine, superior quality of the wine, understand that wine exists in the world and it's prolific. And so... I'm not going to deal with the end of the toast quote, but I wanted to bring that forward as a way to get us outside the meals and into the whole world of wine drinking to begin with. And it's lovely if you don't currently do the practice of blessing Borei Pri HaGafen and HaTova HaMeitiv in your wine drinking. It's a lovely practice to start with a bottle and to know. And I would say, I'm holding like this personally, that saying a Borei Pri HaGafen and knowing you're going to move over to something HaTova HaMeitiv, because you're sitting around and you would have been covered by that Borei Pri HaGafen, because you're in the same room and you didn't need a new Borei Pri HaGafen, to have a nice HaTova HaMeitiv is a nice thing. It's a nice thing.
Is that wine?
This is Diet Coke.
No,
okay, I want to move us to... the bottom of 102A, turn to 102A2. A2. Okay, so we're back in the situation where people were eating their meal reclining. The Kadash Aleihem Hayom, and the day became holy on them. I'm on the right side of the page. Mivi'in lo kos shel yayin, we bring for one of them a cup of wine. V'omer alav kiddushat hayom, and he recites over it the sanctity of the day. In other words, you recite kiddush over it. V'sheini, and then we bring a second cup of wine. Omer alav birkat hamazon, and he recites over it birkat hamazon. Now we have this custom that you say birkat hamazon, quote unquote, over a cup of wine. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda. These are the words of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Ochel v'holech ad shetechshach. He may continue to eat throughout the Bein HaShemashos period until it gets completely dark. Okay. And then you're going to turn to 102b1. Gamru, and when they finish, right, they finish the meal. Kos rishon mevarech alav birkat hamazon. First you recite birkat hamazon, v'hasheni omer alav kiddushat hayom. And the second cup you use for kiddush. Am I? Why does he recite first kiddush?
No, first birkat hamazon and then kiddush.
And then birkat hamazon over two separate cups. No, we're just saying, like, why two cups? V'nemrinchu letarvaihu achada kasa. Let him say both, whichever way you wanted to do it, over one. Why do I need two cups? The Gemara is going to answer. Amar Rav Huna, Amar Rav Sheshet. Rav Huna, in the name of Rav Sheshet, says, Ein omrim shtei kedushot al kos echad. You don't say two blessings that have sanctification, power, and in their own right, over one cup of wine. Now, what's the problem with that? You might say about Kiddush, that of course is a blessing of sanctification. You're sanctifying a day. Right? Mekadesh HaShabbat, Mekadesh Yom Tov. Is Birkat HaMazon a blessing of sanctification?
No, it's a thanks to God.
Seems like it's a Birkat Hoda'ah. A blessing of thanks. It's not exactly clear that it's a kiddush, per se. Except what? When I have Birkat HaMazon to say, over Shabbat at least, I can include a Ritzei V'Hachalitzeinu. I include the notion that there's a Shabbat that I'm celebrating. And when I have a Yontif, I include Eloheinu V'Elohei Avotenu Yaleh V'Yavo. I have a special insertion that recognizes the sanctification of the day. So we think maybe, all right, we're talking about very specific cases where we mention those holidays and Shabbatot that require the insertion within the blessing after the meals. And therefore, am I doing sanctification through that? Same way as Kiddush? Not exactly. But yes, I am. My Tama, what's the reason for the rule? Amar Rabbi Nachman bar Yitzchak, though I don't say it over two, I say it over one. Why? Lefisha ein osin mitzvot chavilot chavilot. I have a principle where I don't bundle up my mitzvot and just use one cup. I want to have two cups because otherwise it looks like the Rashbam says that it's a burden on me. I'm trying to get away, kill two birds with one stone here. Yep. Right? So if I pour one cup, it looks like I'm not taking great care to have proper intentionality for my Kiddush prayer and my Birkat HaMazon prayer. Again, the meta notion here, or no, not even meta, but the more philosophical notion of my real intentionality about these cups of wine and what power they grant and what gateway they create and what they're connected to is truly, for the rabbis, a very important aspect of that cup of wine. And sometimes, I don't know how it works for you, sometimes you get the kiddush, you'll dispense with this quickly, you say the whole kiddush blessing, and then, you know, when you drink this, you really are intended to have this connection between, as I said last Shabbat, if you were here, this food item, this symbolic food item, and that which we have just tried to, from our side, I say try because, you know, ultimately God decides whether or not it's going to really sanctified in the sense of the day starts, the Shabbat goes on as it should, the Yontif goes on as it should. But we, from our side, have done the job of sanctifying the day, of saying this time is precious to us. Now, somehow, it's not a magical thing that through the activation of drinking this cup, that I somehow affect that. But in me, I'm supposed to affect that. And so we don't want to bundle it up, and we don't want to make anybody, you know, feel as though we're minimizing our effort to really do the mitzvot that are necessary to do. If I have Birkat Hamazon to say, I want to have a cup. If I have Kiddush to say, I want to have a separate cup. So here I have Ein Omrim Shtei Kiddushot Al Kos Echad. I don't say two blessings of sanctification over a cup. And I have a further reason, that is, we don't perform mitzvahs in bundles. So where have we seen two cups before? Right? Outside of the end of a day where we have both Birkat Hamazon and Kiddush to say. So this is the launching point for the Tosafot to say, ah, I know where we see two cups of wine. We see two cups of wine whenever there's a Jewish wedding. And they're going to launch off now into yet another area of Jewish life that they're going to relate, we're talking about all this wine. Let me now relate to what we do for Jewish weddings. That's a nice... I love on the page when they're kind of ain't chavilo. You don't bundle things up, but you bundle things up. You bring it all out. You say, here we have the connection to wine in a wedding, and this one I did make sure that I got the right Tosfot, and it's here in both the Hebrew and the English. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Let's pass this around the table. Take that. Let me take you into the Tosafot. Just the Tosafot, you see we've done a lot more Tosafot over the first couple of weeks here of this. Tosafot are wonderful because this is about Jewish life in their time, and they bring out custom in their time and differences between what was going on in the Mishnaic and Talmudic era versus their own time in the Middle Ages in Ashkenaz. Lovely kind of picture of Jewish minhagim, customs and realities of Jewish life. So, if you're following in the Gemara, on the page, just in the Hebrew, I'm on the third Tosafot on Kuf Bet Bet. She'ein omrim shtei kiddushot al kos echad.
The last line
on 4 of 9. Okay, you see that? Last line of 4 of 9 in the Hebrew. Flip over, 5 of 9. All right, so the Tosafot are going to discuss whether or not at a chuppah and at sheva brachot, which are two different traditions in the wedding realities, right? We've heard of chuppah before, and sheva brachot, just to remind people, they're going to talk about both chuppah, which is the wedding ceremony, and sheva brachot, which is the practice of adding the blessings that you say under the chuppah in the last part of the wedding ceremony at the birkat hamazon, at the blessing after the meal at a wedding ceremony, or at a wedding suda, at a meal after the wedding ceremony. And there's the tradition of continuing those days of celebration for a bride and groom 7 days after with guests around a table and a special blessing after the meal that includes the blessings you would have heard under the chuppah. And just as an instructional kind of thing, this is a bencher from a wedding that I attended, and there's a page here, it says at a wedding. These additions are used at a wedding reception or a meal with the couple during the ensuing week at which a minyan is present. 10 adults. The leader begins with this special zimun, the call and response set of prayers that begin the blessing after the meal. And the Sheva Brachot, the seven blessings that were chanted or stated under the chuppah, are added at the end of the blessing over the meal. Three cups are placed on the table, says this venture. Two filled with wine, and the third empty. The leader holds the first cup during the invitation for everyone to begin the blessing. The first six of the wedding blessings are recited over the second cup. Then the leader recites the seventh back over the first cup. Wine from each of the two cups is then mixed in the third cup. And then that mixture is poured back into the first two. One cup is drunk by the leader, and the other is shared by the couple and in many circles and other guests. Okay? So that's what's called Sheva Brachot. One more time, right? You start out with three cups of cups. Two have wine in them. One's empty. Birkat HaMazon has said the blessing, everybody's invited to say it, over one. First six blessings of the seven at the end of that big blessing, of the chanting, are chanted. Seventh blessing over that original cup. The two cups of wine are mixed. The mixture goes back into the two cups. The leader drinks one. The bride and groom the other. Here's the Tosafot. Tosafot say, Yesh no'agim b'chupa mita'am zeh. Here's what our custom is like under the chuppah. From this reasoning, shelo lomar sheva brachot, that you don't say the seven blessings al kos birkat hamazon, over the cup of birkat hamazon by a chuppah. Ela mivi'in kos acher, they bring a second cup. Ve'ein mivarchin ala sheni borei pri hagafen. So, in other words, explaining to you the kind of process that we use with two cups of wine at a wedding feast. Kevan shekvar beirach al kos birkat hamazon, seeing as that they've already recited it over the cup of birkat hamazon, ki ein nachon levarech pamayin, because not correct to recite it twice. Ach Rabbeinu Meshulam haya omer hakol al kos echad, but Rabbeinu Meshulam, however, said it over one cup. The lo dami levirkat hamazon v'kiddush jitrei mili ninho, because when it came to actually birkat hamazon and kiddush, like we read in our Gemara passage, in our Talmud passage, those are two separate things. Aval hacha, but here with the blessings, special blessings, at a wedding feast, chadamiltahi, it's actually one long kind of blessing, birkat hamazon, the birkat hamazon goren levirkat nisuin. Because you're saying birkat hamazon, you can actually just add the seven blessings that you said earlier at the wedding ceremony. Okay? When it said chuppah earlier, it didn't mean the ceremony. It said the wedding feast. So I've just explained how we do birkat hamazon with two cups, and then even a third, as you heard in this manual, right? Did I get a third cup in this Tosafot? No. Somewhere in the halachic development of birkat hamazon, with a sheva brachot, a wedding ceremony feast, I had this three-cup ritual develop. Over here, I've got at least the two, and I've got the one for the leader and the one for the couple. There's a Rabbi Meshulam, though, who says, I can do the birkat hamazon with the seven blessings at a wedding over one. Because not like in the Talmud, where I have two different things with birkat hamazon and kiddush. Uvirkat erusin v'nisuin, But you're going to tell me, maybe because at the wedding ceremony itself there were two cups, I'm going to now relate to this issue of why we use two cups over there. Uvirkat erusin v'nisuin, that means the two parts of the wedding ceremony, and then if you'll recall, we have the first part of the wedding ceremony over a cup of wine. We have the ring and the reading of the ketubah. And then we have a second part of the wedding ceremony, which are the seven blessings. And by the time of the Tosafot, obviously, what? You have them together. You have that full ceremony that I just described. Why do we have to say it that way? Because before that, I didn't have it exactly that way. The history of Jewish weddings here is that I didn't have two parts of the wedding ceremony come together until a certain point where they do come together. Erusin, which is the first part of the ceremony, meaning betrothal, might have happened a year earlier or a period earlier, kind of like what's called engagement by us. And I didn't have that as part of my ceremony per se when I put that chuppah up and I want to have the bride and groom there. Did I need two cups then? No. But now that I have Erusin, Nisuin, Nahagu, Lomar, Al Shtei Kosot, now that I have them together in one ceremony, I have them over two cups. So Rabbi Meshulam, why are you thinking that you should be allowed one cup at the end of the ceremony? Shouldn't we reflect what you do by the chuppah and now how we do the ceremony? Well, Vitama de Rigilin ze below ze, this is due to the fact that when one ends to recite one without the other, as the Gemara is going to say, Kedamar be Ketubot, as the Gemara explains in another tractate, which is called Ketubot, Mivarchin Birkat HaErusin beBeit Erusin uVirkat Chatanim beBeit Chatanim. One recites Birkat Erusin in the house of Erusin and Birkat Chatanim in the house of Chatanim. Ah, here's some of the reasoning that we bring to explain to you why we use the two cups. It originated, of course, like we heard about in the Gemara, because of the old way that we used to do weddings. That you had a blessing over the bride, if you will, when she was forbidden to all others, and God blessed us with that holy separation that we make between a bridegroom and a bride, at her, quote-unquote, at her house, when they arranged the whole wedding. That was Erusin in the past. And then, at a different time, you brought into the chuppah the bride, and you had the blessings that we call now the seven blessings, the wedding blessings. Ah, to end it, va'ad dinahagu likrot ketubah bein tayim, v'hava hefsek l'chach mitkadnim. And now, that the minhag is to read the ketubah in between what we consider to be Erusin, which is different than back there at the Talmudic time, and Nisuin, which is the second part of the wedding ceremony, there is what we call a hefsek, meaning there's a break. There used to be a real break, and now our break is the real break of the ketubah being read. And that's why they do it. Two cups are required. The notion that a break could, in the ancient times, be so long as to say, you know, you arrange this in January with your daughter's getting married, here's the son, you've made the blessing, you arranged everything, and then 6 months down the line in the summertime, you're going to have the wedding, and there you say, and of course you had a cup of wine over there, and of course you had a cup of wine 6 months later. Now that you're going to put them together, you might have thought we should just do it over one, especially because Rabbi Meshulam said he's going to do the end of the wedding feast with one cup. No, we're still going to use two by the ceremony. Why are we going to use two? Because there's still a hefsek in between. What's the break that we take? We take the break of reading the ketubah. And the break of reading the ketubah is as if, ke'ilu, we say in the Hebrew, we took this long break between the engagement and the wedding, And we get this sense in our mind's eyes that we have two separate ceremonies physically and ceremonial kind of pieces to the entire picture of the bride and groom coming together. And that is the separation of these two as bride and groom, the bride being separated for he is being ordained as the bridegroom, and then this seven blessing, what's called Birkat Chatanim here, the groom's blessing, but the wedding blessings, the seven blessings that will be now the blessings of celebration over the next week in and after Birkat HaMazon. And you're going to use these multiple cups to do that, to have more of a sense of sanctification, getting back to our Talmudic passage now, because if indeed the idea is that you're going to sanctify the world and sanctify God and sanctify occasions with using a cup of wine, then in and of itself I have to be thankful for the food we've just partaken of, the festival, the feast that we've just made in order to celebrate the bride and the groom. In addition, we're going to celebrate the particular wedding reality of this bride and groom themselves and repeat the seven blessings for them so that we can lift them into this married life. And I need two different cups. I don't accept that I can do it over one. And as a matter of fact, you even saw it's three over here in the bencher. Different story for a different time about all that development of how many cups you use. So here's my question after all this wine. Maybe we should drink a glass of wine. I mean, obviously it says in Proverbs, and we've noted it before, that Yayin Yismach Levadam.
Levenosh.
Yisamach.
So if that's the case, obviously it relates back to our sources themselves, that wine gladdens the heart, if you will. There wasn't a lot of grape juice. We needed to use this wine as the symbolic drink that we used. There will be some discussion as to other items we can use. There's also a Gemara tradition that, as we said before, that there's some syrupy kind of wine and you pour water in it, mosgolo, kos rishon, and you pour, you're literally adding water to this thick syrupy wine. Why did they, if there's questions about who could afford it, if there's questions about who could afford this kind of beverage, this kind of let's say, kli kodesh, this tool for sanctification, kli mekadesh, why don't they just use water?
Water is not a clean and pure as it's today. It was very contaminated at that time.
So, you could be very right.
Wine used to purify the water.
Right, you could be right in the sense that they would worry on the very physical, kind of concrete level as to the quality of the water that was around. No two ways about it. That somehow you preserved the wine in the barrels or the wine in its right vat and you sealed it and you made sure that it was 100% non-contaminated, and there's all kinds of laws in the Mishnah about keeping it pure and not allowing it to become impure. They shouldn't receive tumah.
Water is an essential in life. In a sense, it's a daily thing. And if you want to, if we're talking about a sanctification, there needs to be something special about it.
So you could use milk. Why did you choose wine?
Wine has always been part of the divine, related to the divine. In ancient Egypt.
Not really. Hold on one second, because I want people to hear what you have to say. Man. So I agree that milk is very difficult to store, and goat milk is the most popular milk in the ancient world there. And a lot of it is used for making cheese. You know, you got to figure out how to preserve it in the best way you possibly can. Drinking it just straight up is not so popular. And so milk, per se, I don't know that it's a candidate. Wine is used from the ancient times.
Wine from antiquity has always been a divine kind of drink. It's used for libation in all sorts of ancient ceremonies. In ancient Egypt, the Egyptian mythology attributes the making of wine to the god Osiris, and the god Osiris was the civilizer, like comparable to all the main deities or the highest gods in the comparable religion. So Osiris is attributed with teaching humanity how to make wine and beer. So wine and beer are, their origin is the divine. Also, when you drink wine or beer, you're in altered state of consciousness. You say Lishavache Bavinosh, that's the lowest level, but in general it's you lose your normal consciousness. And when people lose or in an altered state of consciousness, also back to ancient civilizations, they were thought as being blessed by the divine in some way. They're being touched by God in some way when you're in that altered state of mind. So there's a clear connection between wine and divinity, and that, in my opinion, is why wine is used for blessing. It has a direct connection, not an indirect. It's not because we can drink it. Yes, we can drink milk or water, but wine is special unto itself because of these effects. That's how I see it. Nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the question as to whether or not our changing our general sensations or sensibilities or outlooks or using it in such a way as to be a joy maker, ease us into social kind of connectivity, used in the right amounts, used in the right ways, has anything really to do with their choice, right? If it is because there is a sense of that divine feeling that comes along with the amount of buzz that you receive from a good glass or two, I could definitely see that. That's the
why not whiskey?
So that's there's a debate about
whiskey
the use
modern.
Of whiskey.
Wine is ancient.
Whiskey is not so modern.
Okay, wine is ancient.
There's some debate in this tractate mm-hmm. about what other substances we can use. For sure, shechar. Is used here a beer that's either made of dates or other types, and so whether or not
they fermented everything.
Yeah, whether or not we have other kinds of alcohol is definitely known. It's known to us through the Gemara that we have other types of alcohol. Mm-hmm. Back to the maybe I don't know if it's equal and opposite, but it's definitely opposing just using it for its kind of the sameach factor, for the making joy factor. Is it, and this is debatable, is it that there's a polemic of some sense against some of the godliness of wine in the ancient cultures that they're ultimately trying to face down with the way that the system is created for the rabbis? In other words, if Osiris is the one to have created the divine and taught humanity, and Dionysus is the great god of all things wine and orgy, and the Roman banquet is full of wine stewards and servants, that the symbol itself, being used in the space of sanctifying the rhythms, the creation, the time frames, the rites of passage. You brought up Brit Milah. It's a good question as to when we started using a kos in Brit Milah. I'm going to have to look back. But for weddings and for all kinds of these wonderful moments, I wonder if there isn't some of that thinking going on at the same time that it's really about the great glory of having the fruit of the vine and fermentation and wine as this gladdener of humanity. So it's interesting, and I think that the Tosafot too on the page remind you that even as you're talking about Kiddush wine, and as you're talking about Shabbat, and as you're talking about redemption wine from Pesach, they're going to say, talking about two cups, let me talk about the wedding ceremony. Let me bring in the personal simcha in addition to the communal simcha. And it's lovely. It's just lovely how they're on the page there with the reality of how their wedding ceremonies go in their time.
What's the story of Nine Talki in the chapter of Sorer Gomorre? It looks like they used to like much better the wine than Menichevi.
Right. So Ron is making reference to the remembering back to when we studied the chapter of the rebellious son who is to be brought to the elders at the gate, and if he won't listen to the voice of his mother and father, stoned to death. We say that his rebelliousness and his wild behavior was really caused by two things: imbibing really strong Italian wine and eating raw meat. Remember? So they definitely knew from the international wine trade, as far as international was defined.
They knew what
is
better already.
They knew it was better. No doubt about it. And they knew it was stronger and more potent. For sure. And remember that they also, some people surmise that there was already Spanish wine in the region from the time of the Assyrian expansion. The ancient Assyrian expansion. Because the Assyrians were the first to incorporate at least artistic styles of the Middle East, and then traded some of those with the Assyrian Empire back this way.
Yeah, they found a lot of gods, you know, where they...
Right, so I understand being tested more by whomever's doing that work in Israel about the ancient, the genetics of ancient grapes and wine, taking from the scratchings of some of these, Ron's calling it a gut. It's the...
The two stones.
Yeah, what do you call, I guess you can call it a wine press, but there's also another name for it in English?
It was Eved Rechaim.
Yeah, you have it's called a wine press, but it's also, it's an area where you have kind of a small, what could even look like the size of a larger size kiddie pool, mm-hmm. but it's dug
right.
out of the earth.
Grapes
right, the grapes went in, and people would come with very clean feet.
I love Lucy. Remember that? That's it. She's dancing in the vat.
A
vat. The vat.
Right, the vat. Right. So the Hebrew word for that is gat. It's a vat. It's a wine vat. And so I think I've told you the story that I was at the first one made for people who could get out of their wheelchairs and hold on to ropes and handles and extend their legs and produce wine like the ancient Israelites outside of Yochanan at Lotem's special farm where they're reproducing a lot of experience from the Tanakh. Wonderful experience there, using that gat, using that vat. But they knew from better wine already, like we know from better wine. They definitely did. And this Italian wine, they thought maybe it was
stronger.
I have another theory after reading more after that semester of study about ancient wine and ancient Rome. I think part of that was, and this is a question as to whether or not people in our Gemara knew of the problems with the lead in the pots and pans and storage vessels that the Romans had, but there was an abundance of lead in their pots and their pans and their local kitchen items, and that led to according to some who are along that spectrum of making just a blanket statement, they want to say such led to the fall of the Roman Empire. The investigation has gone further, and I think people have stepped back a little from such a sweeping charge against lead and against the kaleem, the vessels. But there is, in a certain sense, an observation made by a few who study the material culture of the time and its possible effects on the physiology of human beings as a question arose because of the lead content within all of what they found in Roman homes in addition to Roman kind of public theaters and or spaces and army in with army legions, that there seemed to be such an abundance that they weren't surprised that some of the cranial, they found skeletons, they found skulls, some of the evidence about looking at the cranial augmentation, this skull to that skull, or some of the specimens they have that they do this genetic work on, they find what the content is and they see lead, that it was prolific. And maybe it spread, there was just an enormous expanse too of where Roman household pots and dishes and bowls and storage containers, where they made their way in that part of the classic world. And we who were so concerned about the purity of our vessels did not necessarily use those being made by the Roman artisans. We did not suffer the same level of poisoning, and then whether it's birth defects or just over time disease, a damage, but also I think there was some physiological damage bone wise.
I don't know if it accumulates in bone.
Well, somehow they tested whatever material they tested to make these or draw these conclusions that there was a lot of lead that led to a lot of brain damage that led to a lot of families having real problems within the realm of cognition, within the realm of let's say normalcy. That's why Nero was able to bring something up like this. Like people say, the fall of the empire was,
it's like an extreme state
due to the
lead
in the pot.
So why are they used the same tools? So I don't think.
Anyway, the bottom line is that what's my theory? That with the Sanhedrin passage that talks about Italian wine being so strong or such a toxin when it comes to the normative behavior of a child, that perhaps they're talking about drinking from those, either whatever you call them, barrels, or I don't know what a iron kind of container for wine is called. I don't think there's a certain name. We have amphora, which is the clay jar, and we have the barrel, which is wooden. But I understand some wine was kept in these iron Yeah, exactly.
Similar to a pitcher.
Similar to the pitcher. So what's the name of it?
I think it's a flagon.
A flagon. Very good.
But what about the bags of wine? You know, they used to...
Yeah, they had skins, but we're talking about these kinds of vessels where wine was stored, and if it sat for a while, they thought that it could really lead one to a certain kind of either brain damage or madness.
Well, it doesn't happen immediately. It takes generation.
I don't know.
Excess consumption of the alcohol, too, is also dangerous.
Well, there you have it, right?
You could be an alcoholic on wine.
There is the other possibility. The wine was so good, the Chianti was so rich, it was just so lovely that it was very difficult to control how much you drank. And we know that alcoholism was an ancient disease as much as it is a modern disease. We know that there is the use of wine. Another part of what this whole discussion is about is how to sanctify the use of wine in your everyday life, in your religious life. And it mitigates against the kind of abuse, or hopefully mitigates against the kind of abuse that you will see within the context of drinking in one's life, right? We know that the unfortunate reality, by the way, in modernity, now people go around the country talking about this danger within Jewish community, is that sometimes kids get their starts at simchas where there's an open bar or the like. Now, this talks about a community that has either good eyes on their children and desire to ensure safety, or they don't, right? So, again, like the statement about lead, not as prolific and not as and not as dangerous, I think, as some kind of make it out to be. But on the other hand, it's a cultural kind of piece here that has to be contended with, because they, wherever you fall on the debate with genetics and alcoholism, this is a really big issue within the Jewish community. I've said before, people at least feel like they're not able to come clean within the Jewish context about that issue and about this problem, and it's not every synagogue that has created a space for AA. It's not every Jewish community that has welcomed this discussion openly and mindfully when it comes to alcohol abuse, or alcohol addiction. That said, thank God we're supporting some good recovery programs with some good tzedakah through the synagogue after I mentioned it at High Holidays. It did bring out quite a number of very serious contributions from people who have unfortunately experienced it in their families.
It's really a big Jewish problem across the country.
It's big enough. It's big enough that Chabad has several live-in rehab centers, that on the West Coast there's a major liberal Jewish recovery center, that there's a Camp Ramah who's now during the winter launching a recovery program. Mm-hmm. Some of their angle, twofold, you know, failure to launch and this new generation of folks who are just kind of unable to launch, and secondly, if someone has a problem with alcohol, an addiction to a chemical substance, they could find themselves very much helped through the process of recovery by attending this. And it's becoming more and more something that's happening in
the
synagogue.
Is it disproportionate to the population, Jewish population?
I can't answer that question. I don't know.
I would guess it's proportionate.
I don't know. I would guess so. There is what is called JACS, the Jewish Jewish Addiction, Chemically Dependent, and Substance Abuse kind of network that really helps and allows for the kind of embrace that AA would in the secular sense of those who are addicted, family members who are affected by it, and those who would become conscious and helping, not just sponsors like AA has, but folks who want to be in that orbit and who want to help folks in the recovery mode, either by attending Shabbatonim or befriending or getting into talk groups or becoming partners in strength and recovering out of this world.
I can see why we would need a Jewish one, because the AA has a Christian overtones or undertones. director.
You do it in churches, but it doesn't mean that it's only Christian.
So, if you want to bring spirituality, spirituality is brought into the process, so make it Jewish spirituality.
Yeah, some people feel as though it needs more of a Jewish home and
right.
a Jewish twist, and will seek out help with those who can create a spiritual recovery zone with Jewish
right.
anchoring, Jewish vocabulary, Jewish sentiment, instead of some of what they feel is very Christianized. AA itself, depending on where you attend, can either be in a church or it doesn't have to be in a church, remember, right? And there are many meetings that are not Christian by design, and they are secular even by design, and have different styles. But the reality is that as we go through here, we can't leave a section all about wine and not say, again, this is in the vein of helping to create out of this substance in the world a way to make a Kiddush Hashem and to not abuse it and to see it as a helpmate towards feeling the sanctity. We're not blinded to the fact that feeling that sanctity for some might make one or another person want another couple of cups of wine and four cups at a Seder in terms of feeling redemption really is, okay, here's how you ought to think about drunkenness even. Let's say someone really had to, nashim, women are included in that. Men of all weights and shapes and sizes are included in that. Four cups of wine, that's quite a significant amount of wine. If I am now in that buzz told that that is about feeling the redemption of God, and it's to remind me of the going out of Egypt, perhaps I can create that overlay in my mind that I'm supposed to use this for religious purposes. Of course, I think I told you before, my papi, Lava Shalom, was a milkman, and he always said, you're a new person and you're redeemed after a couple of months, so get this new person a new drink. But he was very much on to taking it in moderation.
So how do you allow on Purim to drink until you're completely losing it?
Oh, yeah. So that's a big question by way of alcohol.
Good point.
And that's a whole different halachic topic. Let's just say that there are those authorities who would say you drink one more drink than you normally would. And you're not rip-roaring drunk. And we even looked at in Masechet Megillah together the sugya that one Rav fights over and against the other after they have this big drinking party. And he kills them. I understand. Until you don't know, it just means that you are to be more festive than you might have been, according to the most authorities.
Just pretend that you don't know anything.
Let's finish up this piece of Gemara over here in 102b1, on the bottom. Below? But don't we recite two blessings of sanctification over one cup? I have a brisa that says we recite two sanctifications over one cup. Hanichnas leveito b'motzei Shabbat, one who enters his house after the departure of Sabbath. Mivarech ala yayin v'ala ma'or v'ala b'samim, recites the blessing over wine, and then the blessing over the flame, and then the blessing over the fragrant spices, and afterwards he says the blessing of Havdalah. Ve'im ein lo ela kos echad, and if he only has one cup, here's what the Brita says, what do you do with the one cup? Menicho la'achar hamazon. You leave that cup until after he eats the evening meal, and you recite Birkat Hamazon over it. So even though you said Borei Pri HaGafen on that cup of wine at Havdalah, and you made the Havdalah blessing, and now it's the new week, what are you supposed to do? Have a meal, having set aside that cup of wine, and you say Birkat Hamazon in addition on the same cup. U'mishalashan kulan l'acharav, and he links all the aforementioned blessing after Birkat Hamazon.
Chavilot.
Ah, Elo Shani. But that's when he doesn't have two cups of wine, guys. He only has one cup, and that's different. Ein lo shani. When he doesn't have it, it's totally different. And that's...
Two people can have one glass full.
Ah, so that's back to what? The way we read the first Mishnah with sensitivity towards people who just make... We have to make sure that everybody has their needs met. And that theme comes rolling back in this discussion as well. So we'll let that brayta stand as an example, but we'll explain it that's when you only really have one cup. Okay? So that's the bottom line there, that we're going to incorporate our understanding of people's affordability situation. Yeah?
I like that they said Michelle Shalando, because they could have said Mechumarana. I mean, but this reminds me of Yishalation. So it makes it... I like that. That's why they...
Do a little translating in how you're understanding that.
It sort of brings in a different... Instead of just saying they're combining the blessings in some sort of very methodical, logistical way, they're bringing in the concept of Kiddush.
From Isaiah.
Yeah, but the Sephardic Kiddush, where they actually... That language is there. So, that's just...
Yeah, you have this kind of... You have this kind of triple Kiddush Hashem going on. You have a sense that you're linking one sanctification to the next in this verb, and that it's not just joining two mitzvahs. It's that you're creating
a
chain of Kedusha. Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Nice. Okay, now, the Gemara is going to ask, second side of 102b1 there, Vaha, Yom Tov Shechal Hiyot Achar Shabbos. And let's talk about a case of Yom Tov that falls after Shabbat. Right? Saturday ends, Saturday night is the first day of a holiday. De'itle, it's a time when one has a sufficient supply of wine. But Amar Rav, Rav says, I'll tell you how to do it then. Yakna, Yud Kuf Nun He. Meaning what? You recite the blessing in this sequence. Wine, the Yud. Kuf for Kiddush. Nun for the flame, Ner. And He, Havdalah.
What is the Yud for?
Yayin. Borei Pri HaGafen.
Okay.
So now the Gemara is going to start to deal with all kinds of what do you do when you go from Shabbat into a holiday, and how do I still say both Kiddush and Havdalah? The Gemara answers, Amare, let's say as follows, Midlo Amar Zman, since Rav only mentioned the blessings of wine, Kiddush, the flame, and Havdalah, and he didn't mention what we call Birkat Zman in our parlance, which means Shehecheyanu. Miklal de Veshvi'i Shel Pesach Haskinan. We assume that we're dealing with the seventh day of Passover here. That Shabbat went out and started the seventh day of Passover. Why do I assume I'm talking about the seventh day of Passover? Because Kiddush for the seventh day of Passover does not include Shehecheyanu. Beginning of Pesach includes Shehecheyanu. But this Kiddush of seventh day Pesach does not include Shehecheyanu. Dechol mai dehavale achile. And when he has already eaten and drunk all that he had prepared for the festival, the late, and he doesn't have but one cup of wine, what happens? He says everything together. Okay? Reaffirming what? Reaffirming that we're talking about a situation where someone who's only got the one is given permission and given a system for completing all that's necessary.
Leftover.
The Gemara persists. V'ha Yom Tov Rishon. But there's a case of the first day of Yantiv that falls after the Sabbath. De'itle. It's definitely a time when one has a sufficient supply of wine. You know, I'm sure that he's prepared. Sure that he's prepared. He was prepared for Shabbos, and he was prepared for the first day of Yantiv. That's definitely a time when one has a sufficient supply. But Amar Baye, and now I'm going to have a machloket, classic disagreement, between Abaye and Rava about what I do. Abaye says, Amar Abaye, Yakzina. Yud Kuf Nun Zayin Hey. One recites the blessings in the following sequence. Yud for Yayin, wine. Kuf for Kiddush. Then I make Kiddush. Right? Bray Bray Guffin, and then the Kiddush of the day. Zayin, Zman. I follow up my Kiddush blessing with Shehechianu. Then I say Nun, Ner. And, that's over the candle. And then I say Hey, the Havdalah blessing. And that's everything together over the one cup. Even when he's got enough for the Shabbat and the festival. But Amar Rava, says, aha, it's not that order, it's Yak Nahaz. It's Yayin, it's wine, and then it's Kiddush. And then I'm going to say it over the candle, Ner, and then I'm going to say it over the Hay Havdalah, I made from Shabbat to the first day of the holiday, and then I'm going to wrap it all up with Shehechianu, who caused us to arrive to this day, who granted us life, and who caused us to arrive at this season, at this time. The Gemara answers, Eila Havdalah v'Kiddush Chada Miltahi. Rather, let's just say that Havdalah and Kiddush are considered one big sanctification. Birkat Amazon v'kiddush trei milei ninhu, and Birkat Amazon and Kiddush are two things. And so when you're bringing me the whole Havdalah issue, I'll tell you that Havdalah and Kiddush really are one big sanctification, and the two, Birkat Amazon and Kiddush that we were arguing about before has nothing to do with it. And what's the point? That gets them to the point where they're able to say, ah, I got two things going on here. I got these two that I need two cups for. I got this one that I need one cup for, and now begins a whole discussion of which one do I do first and in what order. Rava and Abaye are the classic people to argue about this. We go according to the second opinion, Rava. And that's why you'll see in Sidurim, and you'll see in the Haggadah, and you'll see in a Machzor for a Yantiv, that when we have a Sabbath that goes out to the day of the first day of the holiday, we have the formula Yak Nahaz, and that will be in the book right in front of you. You say Yayin, you say Broi Pri Guffin, then you make the Kiddush for the day, and then you take Ner Havdalah, and you insert the blessing over the candle and the Havdalah blessing in past this Kiddush before you say the Shehechianu. So you've actually made the distinction between Shabbat and this holiday, and arriving to this time is, you arrived after Shabbos, and you arrived to this holiday. And that's the Shehechianu you're making. It's basically blessing God for having given us this Sabbath and this holiday. The way that you do the Havdalah candle, the light, is a little different than normal. A regular Havdalah, you would have that special braided candle you've seen. But during a holiday, you take the two candles that were lit in the house for the holiday itself, for Yontif, and you, because you can on a holiday, handle them, you pick them up and you hold them together and bring the two wicks together in order to, quote-unquote, make a Havdalah candle, the act of making a Havdalah candle. And it's a little distinction in terms of the custom and practice, in order to make that Havdalah come alive.
How did the holiday... This is Saturday night. So when are these holiday candles being lit, if you haven't...
On Friday night.
And they're still burning?
Maybe.
I don't know. So what's interesting about that is that if I am going out of a Saturday night, right? And I'm finished davening. So let's say I've said Ma'ariv. I've made an official Havdalah within the context of my Ma'ariv service.
So then you can light the holiday candles.
Right.
And then use them for the, finish up the Havdalah.
That's right. There are ways that we have to, and obviously you needed to transfer a flame and not light it anew. So what do I have? I have a 25-hour candle burning alongside my candles that I lit last night for Shabbat that went out. So we're going to say that we now know how to do Kiddush and Birkat HaMazon. We're going to say that we now know how to do Kiddush and Havdalah when it comes Saturday night to the next day. And the next time we get together, what we're going to do is we're going to, let's just see what page it's on. We're going to do a quick take on some other substances out there, some other possibilities for making Kiddush over them, meaning we'll look at what's going on with beer and some other yash, some other liquor, and some other kinds of things. And then we'll push on to the next Mishnah in the Perek, which maybe we'll do reclining before that and talk about a little bit of the whole notion of reclining, because that comes up. But we'll get into the next mission, and that will get us into the throes of the Seder itself. I think that's what we'll wind up doing. There's a discussion of there's a discussion of the four cups in a more expansive way that we are going to actually come back to at some point after we look at some of the other parts of the Mishnah here, so that we can get a sense in terms of where they fit into the bigger picture and whether or not other symbols of the Seder are in a kind of decisive way linked to the symbol or the symbols of the four cups and the beginning of the Mishnah.